All right. It is the 9th of September. This is Cybercrime. The PowerPoints for the first three classes, including the one I'm about to show you, are now on the TWIN page, and the podcast recordings will be posted shortly. I have a revised roster. Hopefully all of you are on it. And here comes the big deal, right? Hold on. Pass this around as well. We get the official count. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, 23. The only reason I'm looking at this funky is because it goes right from Stephen Levy to Sushrut Pandya. Is there no one here whose last name begins with M, N, or O? Then guess what, folks? We are not on a mandatory curve. Which means if you fail, it's your own fault, not that of your classmates. All right. So we are going to continue talking about both, I would say, the opportunities and the challenges.
Can I just interrupt myself?
You certainly may. That's fine. Have people already? Yes, please move him. So none of you is brave enough to sit in the front row. Okay, that's fine. Thank you for fixing it. You know, seating will be on the bar exam. We're going to talk about the challenges and perhaps opportunities for law enforcement officials in the context of digital evidence. But before we do, I wanted to just share with you, thank you, some recent cybercrime-related stories that just have come up in my reading. Anybody have one? Has anyone been a victim? Oh, you do? I shouldn't ask. Oh, cool. I have to look for that one. The answer is probably not much, but it's going to depend on whether you're using work account or not work account and the policies and all those things. There are some real relevant questions for lawyers in terms of lawyer attorney-client privilege and the email system it turns out your client was using when contacting you over which you have no control. But if your client was emailing you from work, using a work account and is about to sue the employer, this is going to be a problem. And hopefully the article discusses at least some of that. But some recent cybercrime news. Breaking Bad prank reminds us all to not put personal info online. So apparently, Aaron Paul, who is Jesse on Breaking Bad, asked his Twitter followers what their thoughts on Breaking Bad were. "Let me talk you through it. Number, please," he wrote. As you might have guessed, excited fans jumped on the possibility of talking to Paul and readily tweeted their phone numbers out. Enter Zio Storm, who called up some of the numbers up in a prank where he pretends to be Aaron Paul. Okay. So, did he in fact ask for phone numbers? The short answer is yes. So here he did. So apparently people did post their phone numbers. Maybe they're not there now, maybe they are. But this just shows you, not so much that Aaron Paul was committing a cybercrime, nor that this Zio Storm person, whoever that is, was pretending to be Aaron Paul and calling those numbers. But I call this out because it is a really fine example of what's called social engineering. Social engineering is a method for gathering passwords and other secure information by non-technological means. So, you get a call from someone who claims to be in the IT department of your employer, and person asks for some login information. Or you use a password that is your mother's maiden name and that's available somewhere. You get a call that you've won something. Social engineering is not just in the context of cybercrime. Some of my favorite stupid criminal stories involve lotteries and sweepstakes. Every few years you see one of these stories on the news. The stupid criminal segment. You know about this? They did it in Florida a number of years ago. Basically, they have warrants out for all these people. And they call them or write them and say they've won a television set. Come on down. And they do. And they get arrested. Or whatever it is served with. Sometimes it's unpaid. Child support kinds of crimes. But people come. They like to get things. People like them. Here is your semi-homework. Additional semi-homework. Not a real hard one. For those of you who have Netflix, if you don't, go find a friend. Do not take that person's password. A movie has come back up onto Netflix in the last week that I want you all to have seen. And unfortunately, many of you will not have seen it yet. It's called War Games. How many of you have actually seen the real War Games with Matthew Broderick and Ali Sheedy? Okay, not enough of you. This is 1983. John Stamos. He was busy doing other things in 1983. I think he might have still been on General Hospital in 1983. So watch this film. Don't watch the sequel, which is more modern and is just a blatant copy and not good. Watch War Games. It's fun. It's short. It's very dated. Remember while you watch it that at the time it was made, we really thought that we were going to get into a world-ending nuclear war with the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. That context makes no sense today, but it did when it was common knowledge, but watch this film, because it really is a great illustration of that balance between hacker and malicious hacker. I don't want to spoil, not that it's not part of common parlance, but really, watch this film. I want you to do it sometime when you need a break over the next week. I'd love to hear feedback about it next class. Please try to find time if you have Netflix, a couple hours, it's not even. Watch the film. But on the topic of social engineering, and I don't think I noticed this until I actually watched it again yesterday while doing dishes, and I noticed a point that I hadn't seen. The protagonist, a very young Matthew Broderick, gets the password to the school system. It's the first 5 minutes of the movie. I'm not spoiling anything. How does he get the password? Because it's written in a desk drawer in the secretary of the school principal. What I didn't notice was that he says to Ali Sheedy a few minutes later, they change it every month, but you know, I know where it is. What I didn't realize is he probably got himself sent to the principal intentionally. He misbehaves as soon as he walks in the classroom, gets sent to the principal. Principal's getting tired of seeing you, David. Why do you think he keeps going back to the principal's office? So while he's waiting to speak to the principal, he can open the drawer and see the most recent password. That's social engineering. He engineered his way into a position where without technology, he could get access to the password. And so we have social engineering. Now, did Aaron Paul intend that? Probably not. Maybe he just wanted to show people how easy it is to get them to put their telephone numbers right out there. Okay. Story number two. How Self Tower Dumps Caught the High Candy Bandits, High Country Bandits, sorry, and Why It Matters. So this is from Ars Technica from August 29th. So this is about a couple of bank robbers. The High Country Bandits in Colorado, grandiose name for a pair of middle-aged white men who've been knocking down rural banks. I think they mean knocking over. They must be really small banks that they were actually knocking them down. Granted, grabbing a few thousand dollars from a teller's cash drawer and sometimes escaping on an ATV. Okay, so how did they get caught? As the regional robberies continued, it says, the FBI was brought into the case. I know you can't read it from where you are. They found a witness to one of the robberies who had seen a suspicious man hanging out by the bank a couple of hours before the robbery, talking on a cell phone. But how does one find a single cell phone user without knowing the cell phone number or the subscriber's name? Indeed, without knowing anything but the time and location. If you're the FBI, you ask the judge to approve a full, quote, cell tower dump, in which wireless operators will turn over the records of every cell phone that registered with a particular tower at a particular time. Phones register with the nearest cell towers so that the network knows how to route calls. And then you look for any numbers that stand out. Think about that in the context of this discussion that we're having today on digital evidence, on the methods. Now, the FBI agents, it goes on, asked a federal magistrate judge to approve four of these cell tower dumps. Investigators picked the four most rural locations in order to minimize the amount of extraneous telephone data that would likely be obtained through such a court order. Including the bank in Pine Top, said the FBI, the judge approved the request. And it wasn't a warrant, it was a court order because of the type of data, as we'll discuss in greater detail throughout the later in the semester. When you look at the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, the main federal law covering telecom privacy, the kind of data, somebody buzzing? Who's got a modem? No, I know what it is. Somebody's watching War Games. according to the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, the kind of data you would obtain from the cell tower dump, falls under what's called the pen register statute. Non-content. You're not tapping into the messages themselves. And that type of data has lower protection, less protection to it, than does content data. But think about the power of that tool on the strength of a court order, and there's no allegation in the article or really in the law that what they did was illegal. But they got every cell phone number that used those four cell towers in that period. Everyone. Criminals, non-criminals. That's how quickly. Imagine if they had had to subpoena. What? How else could you have gotten those data? How else? Practically speaking. What? You'd have, any idea? What do you think? Warrant for what? That's what I'm saying. Practically speaking, what else could the police have done to find out who was speaking on cell phones in those areas during that time? Any thoughts on that? What do you think?
What if I said that someone saw it?
Right.
Don't they usually have surveillance?
They might have surveillance cameras, so follow that through. So the police, surveillance cameras, then what? And once they did, what then? Let's say they have it. What do you do with that surveillance camera data? Because you're right.
Can you take a picture?
All right. No, I think you're absolutely correct. The same way.
Yes.
Right? Like that. But think of how much more... First, you're assuming you're going to get a clean head shot, a face shot, and they didn't hear, and that there would be a camera pointed in the right direction. And even if they did, they still don't identify it. Now, let's say that apparently it worked, but let's say they got those cell phone numbers and they traced them to the phone owners. Is that enough? What's the most they know from those tower records? Who used the phone? No, they don't. They know that someone with a phone with that number used that phone. If it was your phone and the bandits, the high country bandits, stole your phone just before going to Pine Top and used your phone, it wouldn't identify them, it would identify you. So it's not identity, but it's certainly a step in the right direction. And with that, and maybe some other information, right? So then they could see who these people are. Maybe some of them have felony records. You know, maybe they have a photo because someone shows up on a name database of potential, you know, prior arrests, and they can match it to. You could do something with those data, and obviously they did. But just think about the power of digital evidence that this story represents. Okay. So we all depend on passwords. Here's another story. There is no favor what we bake. Turbocharged cracking comes to long passwords, August 26th. So this is a freely available password cracker program, which is able to tackle passcodes with as many as 55 characters. Forget about, you know, minimum of 6. Before this, it was 15 or fewer characters. Now it can go 55, depending on how. It can go as high as 64, as low as 24. How do they do this? They use lists of leaked passwords. So even if these are encrypted, but let's say some other website was broken and those passwords leaked out. Now, it doesn't mean it's the same user. But what it does is it gives this program an entire library of things that people have used as passwords. Not just regular common words, but lyrics from songs. Common substitutions of letters for numbers. And the more background information this program has, the more likely it is to do it right. Now, why is this legal? That's true, but why is it legal, or why should it be legal, to distribute a freely available tool whose purpose is to crack passwords to accounts? Would it be legal to sell tools that were designed to open commonly used house locks? It would, wouldn't it? Why? Is there a legal purpose for having tools that can...
To train people to make better locks that...
That's certainly... Any more sort of common, prosaic...
Locksmiths.
Absolutely. I got locked out of my house. Well, I need to, you know... So locksmiths need to be able to get into locks in order to get you into the house. And then they can rekey the locks. Or you buy a home, a foreclosure sale or whatever, keys are missing. There are plenty of legal situations where being able to open a physical lock and having needing the tools to do that is okay. Landlords, you know, a lot of the tenant illegally changes the lock and the landlord needs to get back in. You don't want to destroy the entire door, so you pick the lock. What about password cracking tools? Are there equivalents? Who would need to crack a password besides a malicious hacker? Someone who forgot their password? Absolutely. Absolutely. Anybody else?
Law enforcement.
Law enforcement. Subject to whatever restrictions there are, and we're getting into that. Next week we'll do even more. Any others? Systems administrators whose users changed or forgot the passwords, didn't report them. What about you future trusts and estates lawyers? You know, the decedent dies without giving up the passwords to the bank records. And you have someone who has inherited that account but can't get access to it. Or maybe the will is sitting on a computer somewhere. Or some other relevant document. Lawyers, too, may have the need of those tools to crack passwords. So it isn't the development of them. And yes, there is a certain amount, just as the suggestion of use these tools to train people to build better locks. Similarly, one of the reasons that these types of tools are developed and then freely shared is a kind of cultural wake-up call to password users and to the people who design password technology not to rely over much on passwords. Of course, there are some stories this week that says the NSA can already crack standard encryption, so we're all out of luck. But in any event, I know we're not going to go down that topic with the people walking around. Yeah, that's not a conversation I would want to be overheard and misunderstood. And speaking of surveillance cameras, did you know that in Ohio and probably elsewhere, law enforcement officials are scanning pictures of suspects and matching them to driver's license photos in the law enforcement database. So basically, you have driver's license photos and you have other kind of publicly accessible photos. And those are now being used to matched to surveillance cameras without people for a long time there's been a scandal about private use, about states selling DMV data. And there are certain states have certain laws about it. It's not entirely fully fleshed out. But intra is within, I think. Yes. Intra-governmental use of data. If you have your picture taken for the DMV, do you expect that state police now include your picture in a criminal's scan, criminal database? Maybe you do, maybe you don't, but should you be told? You know, there are actually federal law, the first major federal electronic or federal privacy law at all had to do with the government keeping information it has private from other aspects, you know, other branches of government. Because we have to give the government a lot of information, but different branches use it for different purposes. And this challenge is not whether the police are using it or may the police use it, but that they are, and maybe they should be providing consent or requesting consent or at least providing notice, and maybe they should make sure that the same technology is not, you know, cannot also be used by an officer to just, you know, check out that late, you know, that pretty woman he saw get a picture, or take those pictures and do other things with them. You know. A lot of stuff going on. Okay. Questions, thoughts, comments? I try to leave enough time because this is an evolving area. And so keep an eye out so that if you do see stories, we can talk about them, because as you see, all of these things in the last couple of weeks are directly relevant to what we're learning. One of the reasons I think that I don't rely so much on the cases is because this is an evolving area. These are not so much useful for precedential purposes. Some of them are, the ones that you see referred to by the other cases. But a lot of these are local cases. They're there because they show the thought process. And the thought process is informed by the changing in understanding and the changing in technology. So, a quick reminder of our Fourth Amendment. At the heart of all governmental searches, law enforcement-related searches, protections against unreasonable searches and seizures, and the associated warrant requirement, not only needing a warrant, but the details of the warrant, that it has to be supported by oath, probable cause, and with particularity. And as we started talking about last week, in thinking about the Fourth Amendment, the first question is, does it matter at all? Is it relevant? We have to see if there's government action. Assuming there is this a search or a seizure in accordance with the law? Are we searching equipment or data? And then some of the exceptions, and I added this one to our list from the slide because, of course, it's very relevant here, the plain sight exception and what that means. We began some of those discussions, and we're going to continue them. What that means in the context of files on a computer, their names, what's in them, the exigent circumstances, consent, which we'll talk, I think, more about next week, searches incident to an arrest and inventory, border searches and the like. We talked last class about what it means to seize something. The meaningful interest with an individual's possessory interest, meaningful interference with an individual's possessory interest in the individual's property. And how that plays out, or could play out, that analysis when coming to questions of computers, devices, the data on them, and whether copying could be, would, should be considered a seizure under this definition. Reading it, copying the drive, listing the files, and so on. So that's our framework. That's our framework for our discussion today. The Fourth Amendment being there, being applicable, of course, the exclusionary rule, the doctrine that has developed that if law enforcement officials violate the Fourth Amendment, then the fruits of the searches or the seizures, the evidence that is derived directly or indirectly from those violations, may be suppressed and not used, even if someone who has in fact committed the offense goes free. And that rationale is there to remind, rather strongly, law enforcement officials of their constitutional responsibilities. Because the Fourth Amendment does not itself provide that remedy. Does it? There's nothing in the Fourth Amendment that says, and if this isn't followed, the evidence is inadmissible. It's not there. It's a doctrine that has developed as a reminder of this, because without that remedy, oops, sorry, Your Honor, is not going to do it. That's not going to keep police, because with the best of intentions, law enforcement officials might not observe this because their concern is stopping the crime, capturing and punishing the criminal. And this acts as a check on that. It says not everything goes. So we have this. But we also have the exceptions that have developed to this doctrine. Notably, the plain view doctrine that is at the heart of much of what we discuss here. So what's the plain view doctrine? Just generally, what's the plain view doctrine?
Any evidence that's in plain view of government officials and invisible government?
Sure. Now, it's not just government officials, but it's government officials in the context of a legal search, right? If they're there illegally, you don't get to use the plain view stuff, because that would be excluded. But you're right, that even if they're there and there's no warrant or there's a limited warrant, if while they're someplace legally, oh look, what's that rather large pile of marijuana smelling stuff over there? Oh wait, this is Colorado, never mind. Right, if it's there, and you see, I'm sure you can come up with lots of offline examples of this. Stopping a car for a traffic violation, some sort of a broken light or whatever, and discovering weapons or other contraband in the car. So that has developed. Because otherwise, again, it would be an artificial restriction. But as we see, it's not without controversy, especially with regard to digital evidence. Because, you know, what's in plain sight? Right, a piece of plastic. Now what's in plain sight? Well, it's a little Superman dude. It's a password screen, right? Now what's in plain sight? Icons representing some of the programs on my phone. And the same is true for computers. Unless it's literally on the screen when you walk in, it isn't actually in plain sight. But that hasn't stopped some of these cases from extending that in ways that we can certainly discuss whether they are too far. So let's go through the cases. Okay. OVA. Can you please help us with U.S. v. David?
So, looks like it was a federal court.
Okay, where?
Nevada.
Okay, tell us about this case.
Looks like David was arrested on a conspiracy to smuggle heroin.
Mm-hmm.
And he entered into an agreement with the government to cooperate with them to disclose some records.
Yep.
So he had information about password, telephone numbers and passwords.
Mm-hmm.
And he had several meetings with a special agent to disclose those.
I'm listening. I'm illustrating. So what was the search in this case? What happened here?
Monitoring the phone call?
No. It's not what they did. What did they do? What was the information they needed? It's in the little parenthetical.
Yeah.
I see it.
What was it they wanted? They wanted the phone numbers. Where were they? It's not in the parenthetical. It's in the first paragraph of David in the book. Where were these phone numbers?
On his computer?
Well, he had a little electronic diary. He had a PDA. Pre-smartphone. So, but it was password protected. So how'd they get the password? Did they crack the password? Did they bring in high-tech guys? Did they pump him through truth serum? How did the police get the password? He was. How'd they get it?
They used that password to forge it.
How did they get it? This is really important. Top of page 54 in the book. What does it say there? First complete sentence. Yep. That's what he did. That's why I did my little trip around. That's what he did. He literally looked over his shoulder and watched his little fingers. And that's how they got the password for this thing. Was that a search? What do the courts say? What's the question you have to ask before you even ask if it was a constitutional search? What do you need in order to begin that question?
Is it a Fourth Amendment question?
When does the Fourth Amendment kick in? Yes, you need government action. But when would someone have the protection of the Fourth Amendment? A reasonable expectation of privacy. And did the defendant have a reasonable expectation of privacy of his password in this case? Why not? What does that mean, it was in plain sight? It wasn't on the screen. It's what he did. They watched his fingers. He didn't go hide it under the table. The guy was literally standing behind him. It was literally in plain sight. If you're going to key in your password while being watched, right? What does the court say? David voluntarily accessed the book. They say book, but it's really an electronic device. At a time when the agents were in close proximity to him. Agent Peterson was not required to stay seated across the table, nor did David have any reasonable expectation that Peterson would not walk behind him or remain outside of some imaginary zone of privacy, it's like the cone of silence in the old Get Smart, within the closed room. It was Peterson's office. He could move about it whenever he pleased. There you go. Just like you have no reasonable expectation of privacy in the contents of your computer screens, because a nosy professor can come in the walk around, or for that matter, there's a door in the back, and the dean could walk in at any moment. No, I'm just kidding, right? Or anyone else. Some of these rooms have cameras, and I can control them from the front, and then you could really zoom in on the screens. You don't? Do you feel a reasonable expectation of privacy in your computer screens? You shouldn't. Not in this room. Not in the way it's laid out, neither should David. And so, you do something in plain sight, literally in plain sight. The fact that it's electronic, it's a password being entered, didn't matter. They didn't even have to get to the question of whether it was a reasonable search or not, because there was no expectation of privacy triggering any sort of warrant obligation. The court need not reach the question of whether the plain view doctrine would save the legality. So this isn't even a plain view case. Because a plain view case presupposes a warrant. Otherwise, there would have been a warrant obligation. And the warrant obligation only happens where there's reasonable expectation of privacy. You don't need a warrant if someone comes up and says, I confess, you know, in the middle of Times Square, right? The people who arrested those guys right outside of Dateline NBC, the house, right, with the cookies, the cops standing outside watching the feed didn't need a monitor because they weren't searching anything. These people were talking to, what's his name, the TV dude, Chris Hansen. So, what do you think is happening here? Right, whatever it is. You know? It's like I told you about the Gorshkov case last week. I mentioned that there was this Russian malicious hacker dude. They brought him to the U.S. pretending to be giving him a job. Here, log into your computer. You can use our computer, no problem. Check out your stuff. And of course, it was the computer belonged to the FBI or whatever. He put in his password. They were logging everything. No, somebody else's computer. They don't have an obligation to tell you the truth. Not in these contexts. And here, you know, I'm just stretching my legs. Oh, okay. Fortune. So that was sort of setting the stage. But what about when you do have a law enforcement situation? What about U.S. v. Wilson? Karen, did you do last week? Last class?
No.
Would you like to, please?
Sure.
Thank you. I think you had. I'm sorry for asking you twice. Start marking this. That's right. Please to present U.S. v. Wilson.
When officers
are... Where are we? Where is this case?
This case is in
federal
district court in Missouri.
Okay. So it's the Eighth Circuit trial level. Right? No. No, it's not. Eighth Circuit. So this is the Court of Appeals. This is an appeal. The original case was in the district court.
So
right? U.S. v. Devin Wilson. Okay. Yes. Okay, we can read that. Brief the case for us. What's the issue here?
Whether the incriminating character of the items were immediately apparent.
So, okay. So who saw them when?
Well, the victim described numerous objects that allegedly incriminated the defendant. Phone.
Okay.
And she described the exact locations of where the officers could find the items.
Okay.
So one of the officers found the video camera exactly where the victim told him to look, and found the cell phone as well. And he opened the phone and observed pornographic photos.
Okay.
And then the defendant was seeking to.
Stop. There's a really important set of facts between what you just said and the second to last and last sentences you just said. Really important for this purpose. Different investigations, two different police departments, right? Months apart. The first one is this alleged kidnapping. And of course, given the editing, we don't know what happened in that first case. But that was the first case. It was the Caruthersville Police Department coming in to seize evidence with relation to a kidnapping. Full stop. Several months later, right? FBI agent Herbert Stapleton went to Wilson, that's the defendant's here, residence to execute a federal arrest warrant for the crime of being a felon in possession of a firearm. So, one was a local case, maybe it was the same fact, different investigation, arrest warrant in place. What led Agent Stapledon to look at the camera? He was aware of it. Having become aware of it, he recognized the camera. He thought he did. Right? He seized it. And later, they searched the data and found this. And so, what is the key here? What's the key? Was there a warrant to seize the camera when Stapledon seized the camera?
No.
No. What kind of warrant did he have?
It was for... the possession of firearms.
What kind of warrant was it? Was it a search warrant? It wasn't. What? It says right there. It's the one, it's the paragraph that begins several months after. It was an arrest warrant. It wasn't a search warrant. He walked in to arrest Stapledon for possession of firearms, a federal offense, looked around, views the camera, says, I recognize that camera. They thought it had porn on it. Let's take it and find out. You laugh. That's what happened. And he took it, and then they got a warrant to search the camera and the phone and the other things. At which point, okay, good. They found it. They've charged him. And so what does Wilson claim here? What does he say about this evidence? What's he asking to have it have done? Why?
It doesn't fall under the Plainview exception.
Well, let's start with, why do you even need to go to the Plainview exception? What didn't they have?
A warrant.
They didn't have a warrant. So, police, you don't have a warrant. What's their response? We didn't need a warrant. Why? Plainview exception. But what's the counter argument that Wilson uses here? What was in plain view? A camera. Did it have a screen open showing child porn? No. And based on at least what's here, we don't even... I mean, yes, it looks like the same camera. You know, my wife and my daughter have the same camera. One has girl stickers on it. That's my daughter's camera. It's the only way we can tell them apart. So he thought he recognized the camera, a camera from the photo. He seized it and then searched it. And they're claiming plain view. Right? So we had the prior case. So there's this trail of seizures. The local PD seizes the phone and looked at it. He got the information. Local police officer. They pass that on to the FBI. The FBI walks in, sees a video camera. Oh, we'll take the video camera. Let's search both. Found child porn, charge him. So there's this entire chain where you have these two, essentially two seizures, but the second one arising from the first. And what does the court hold with regard to the plain view exception here? They fall under the plain view exception. The seizure of these items was proper. Why?
Well, they said that evidence is immediately apparent. There is probable cause to associate the property with any criminal activity. So they don't necessarily have to be sure or certain, but only that the facts available to a reasonable, cautious man would believe that some criminal
And how do you feel about this?
It's a little scary.
Okay, that's not a law student. That's a future defendant view of things. How do you feel as a law student who ostensibly has read and thought about the Constitution, has thought about law enforcement, has read the opinion here? What do you think of the rationale here? It is, isn't it? Because nothing here was in plain view. The storage items were in plain view. Yes, the camera wasn't in a drawer. It was sitting out. The phone was sitting out. But the incriminating evidence, the allegedly incriminating evidence, based on testimony that was not part of the search warrant, not anywhere. It's not a bag of drugs. And it's not the only case of this type, but it really, if you think about the chain here, two sets of agencies, both of which, right, were in the process, not even in the process, they both got warrants. One got an arrest warrant. One got a search warrant. Did the warrant, I'm not quite sure. Does anyone have the full case here? In handwriting to the warrant application. So, unfortunately, it's not all that clear from, yeah. Yes, I think you're right. I think let's assume you're correct. But there is one significant problem with allowing that assumption, which is, why didn't both get a warrant? They were arresting, even in the second situation, they were arresting this guy. They had the evidence. Why didn't they have, ultimately, if there was reasonable suspicion, they could have had a warrant to seize the camera. It was months later. It was a camera. I don't even want to say the camera. Because we don't really know. He walks in and a video camera is sitting on the table. Looks like the same one. I'm going to grab it, and then we'll see about... I understand. Yes, you're right. Here you have some testimony tying in, some initial police activity, but neither officer had a search warrant. Yeah.
Well, they could have also just seized it and then asked for a warrant. As well.
They did that.
But they looked through it first.
No, well, even if, whether or not they seized the camera without a warrant. But, yes, but a lot of times the seizures are, I think, more in an exigent circumstance situation. You're trying to preserve the evidence. Here, again, what we have, it doesn't even say that. And maybe that's true. And maybe this, but seizures as well require warrants, require process, and it wasn't here. But yet, what we see from this case is how broadly the courts are willing to read, at least some courts, the plain view exception when what is in view is not actually in view, particularly if it's stored. Which brings us, there's some discussion of some of these other cases in the notes. You see someone who's searching for through electronic mail, and he sees files with names like 10-year slut, young sex 15, kid sex 1, 10-year-old, you're looking at the... So if you have file names, and we saw this with the tax software case last class, which was ultimately not a criminal investigation, but there was a question of the reason, whether he had a reasonable expectation of privacy. And once they said, well, you don't have a reasonable expectation of privacy in the computer, and the files were named something that gave probable cause to take the next step, fine. When you have file names that are fairly indicative, childporn.jpg or whatever, of course, these are all PCs, because on Macs, file names are irrelevant. You don't need an extension, and the operating system couldn't care less what the extension is. It bases it on the actual file and what it is. So you can see that even if it's named spreadsheet, if you're looking at the properties, and there are lots of different ways to view files. So, oh, this is actually an image file. Okay, it says spreadsheet, but it's not. But the assumption here is that the dot extension on the file tells them it's likely to be a photograph. Okay, fine. But if you have a file name that is, you know, suspicious, okay. But that's not the content. Just like in this bank robbery case that we started with, there is less protection for phone numbers dialed than for what is said. There may be less protection for a listed file name than there is for the contents of that file. But what if we're not talking about a listed file name? Which brings us to U.S. versus Gray, and brings us to Alexander. Are you here?
Yes, I'm here.
Would you please share with us the facts and analysis of U.S. v. Gray?
FBI agents.
Where is this case being heard?
In Virginia.
Okay, what level case is it?
District Court.
Okay, so it's a trial case.
Yes.
All right.
So FBI agents executed a search at Gray's home in connection with an investigation of unauthorized computer intrusions.
What's an unauthorized computer intrusion? That mean computers walked in the door without permission?
Gray was accessing the National Institute of Health, National Library of Medicine.
Allegedly.
Yes.
Right. So it was a malicious hacking case.
And the FBI seized and removed four of the defendant's computers from his home.
Mm-hmm.
And at the FBI office, Agent Arthur Ewan performed searches throughout the computers relating to the National Institute of Health, National Library of Medicine.
Right, all right, so.
And during the search, they're using a program called CopyPit.
Right.
And going through the files, they came across folders of files labeled Teen and Tiny Teen, and opened them and discovered child pornography.
Mm-hmm.
And the agent's search was found to be within the scope of the search warrant.
All right, so was this a pornography investigation?
No, it was not.
Okay, so they're copying files because of this malicious intrusion, right?
Yes.
All right, and then did he just see the file names, which were suspicious enough? What is this CompuPic?
It's the computer program that they use to open the files.
Well, it doesn't actually.
Thumbnail size images of all the items contained within the file that they appear on the screen.
Right. So let's see what that sort of looks like, okay? God only help. God help me if somebody has put nasty stuff on this computer because I'm screwed. All right, I'm fairly confident with this. So here is, hold on. Here's a list of the files. I'm going to turn off the lights for a second so you guys can sort of see this. Okay. Here is a list of the files in the IBLT directory on the network. All right, you're not going to see here Tiny Teen. But lots of file names, you don't really see much of anything, right? But then, I don't need CompuPick, because I can just say thumbnails. It's just one of the ways to view files. And oh look, if it's a PDF or other kind of picture, you can actually sort of see it. And depending on the operating system, you may have more or less detailed. But here's an image. Can you see this? That's an image. It's not just the Toro logo. That's the picture. Here's some photos. So, but this wasn't what this officer was doing. All the officer had in listing the files, just so you get a sense of the practice here, was this. But he went further. He used his CompuPick and also got this, essentially. Thumbnail pictures, so you could see if there was a photo. All right, so motion to suppress. So was there a warrant here? Generally speaking, yes. Was there a warrant?
Cover your eyes.
So why is there a suppression here? Or why was there a suppression request here?
Because the child porn tiny Taylor wasn't related to the reason for their search.
And not only wasn't it related, it wasn't in the warrant.
Yes.
Right. So remember, what was our warrant requirement? Oath of affirmation, probable cause, and? What? Items to be searched what? Describe how? Particularly describing the place to be searched and the person or things. Particularity. You have to specify what I'm searching for. Here wasn't true. So the argument is, you know, he didn't look at the pictures. He didn't have to look at the pictures. They weren't relevant here. Wasn't part of this. So how is it? How did he see the pictures?
Well, in his testimony, Agent Ewan, in his testimony, when he testified, he said Tiny Teen was the next subdirectory listed when he was opening the folders.
Right. How did he see that there were pictures, though? Because he was using this software. If he had just been, yes, he might have seen Tiny Teen. But if he had not been running this CompuPick software that shows thumbnails of images, and there were no images involved in the allegations, he wouldn't have seen it. He went beyond the file listing in order, and what we see here in the case. He then asked another card agent to view the pictures displayed on his computer screen. On doing this, the agent agreed the pictures appeared to be of minors. The only reason that there were pictures on his computer screen was because he ran an additional piece of software to show pictures. And that's really the argument here. It's not just that he went into these directories, or even that he looked at some of the file names, or the file extensions, .jpg, yes. And there's something to be said for that. You know, if it isn't, if what you're hiding is a list of criminal associates in a spreadsheet, you can call it .jpg and then it won't open. Casually, it won't open. Okay. But it's not, he didn't just list the files, he also used software to view pictures, and that's where he got this. It's not just about the name of the files. Oh, let's get a search warrant to now. That's given us probable cause to go further. They had the computers. They had the files. There was no exigent circumstances. But this court, too, found that it was within the scope of the warrant, and you can see how that's an expansive reading of the warrant. I'm not saying the court is incorrect. I'm certainly not saying that it was acting from other than positive means. But this, if you want to consider the real world equivalent of this, what would be the real world equivalent of what this officer did? You know, I'm not so sure if it was necessarily an x-ray machine, but imagine you're searching a house, and you have a search warrant to look for weapons. And there are books on the shelf. And, you know, maybe the books on the shelf could include weapons catalogs, and that might give me some information. And you pull down a book on the shelf, or maybe it's a photo album. You see, it's a photo album. Oh, maybe there's a photo in here of the defendant holding a weapon, and therefore that will give us better evidence. And you flip it open, and it's child porn, because everybody keeps child porn in photo albums on their shelves. Would that be plain sight? I don't know. Or maybe, you know, you're looking for stolen medical supplies. That's probably a better real-world analog because it was a break-in at the National Institutes of Health. You're looking for stolen medical supplies. Maybe there's a photo of somebody holding a syringe. Oh, look, child porn. It's a real reach. But by the same token, you can see that both the police and the courts are really faced with a significant challenge here. Because this isn't physical evidence. It's not always so easy to discern, to find. And it's also not always so easy to figure out where the limits are. You know, you have these cases where they talk about, and that's really the next case, the Frazier versus State really shows the challenge of the limits here. Challenge of the limits here. John, be so kind as to help us with Frazier versus State, if you would.
I actually did sign.
Okay, but when did you ever read these? Or you just skipped it over? So you read the first and the third, but not the second, or the second and the fourth. Okay, fair enough. Please to remind me, you're up next time. Since we know now, you'll have had an extra week to comprehend. Yeah, it is, I grant you, and I thought I'd mention this, and it is a little confusing, especially given a lot of the overlap, but the assignment on the right side of the syllabus is for the following class. So, you know, that's where you would have been. Okay, fair enough. So I'll ask for a volunteer. Was that a hand?
Yeah.
It was. You have to be like assertive. Volunteer, please tell us about Frazier versus State.
Okay, so thinking it's in Indiana.
Okay, so it's an appellate, but it's an appellate decision in a state court.
Right.
Okay.
On November 1st, the Brown County Sheriff.
Okay. Brief.
Okay.
What kind? Thank you.
So originally the detectives wanted to, search the computers for marijuana and contraband material.
They were searching the computers for pot?
No.
It's important, what is the wording of the items to be searched? You have no
career in law enforcement. I do not.
And I'm with you on that. Paraphernalia.
And things of that nature.
I don't know.
I'll go on.
Keep, okay. It's important because up until now, unless it's a really creatively shaped computer, We don't have computers even remotely in any of this. What's the next thing? Fine. So, I'm going to stop you. Just on a basic level, which of those might remotely authorize a computer, an officer, to look within the records of a computer?
None of that.
No, none of those.
I guess. All the records.
Yeah. Notes and/or records. At least isn't arguable. It's not paraphernalia, unless it's, again, computer-controlled grow lab. But where do you keep notes and or records? You might well keep them on a computer. So it's not totally out of the realm to be searching the computer with these words on your warrant. But go ahead.
Okay.
So what happened? Yeah, I think that might be a typo. I don't know. Anybody have the original case here? In any event.
So he pretty much entered into the premises and went onto the computer.
Okay.
He started opening files. He went onto the desktop, went to my menu, started opening the related files, and realized that some of the files were listed.
Okay, but so what did he see when he looked at the computer? Not the right case. It says he noticed an icon labeled smoke. Okay. We're getting there. And then he did what?
He opened it.
Okay, and he
and
saw... passing drugs
right.
tests. Okay. And then he saw, okay, it's a document. So then what did he do? Where? But look, so what he, this is, I think, again, it's important. The case does talk about the process here. So he's on the desktop. Let's get to a desktop. He sees an icon marked smoke. He opens up the document. Here's trademark infringement. Oh, it's a PowerPoint. Fine. And then what did he do? He went to the start menu, went to documents.
Went to related documents.
He just went to documents. That one wasn't in the documents file. It was a document. It's as if to say, okay, oh, there might be other PowerPoints here. Now I'm going to start searching through the computer looking for PowerPoints. That's what it was. It was a document. He opened it up on the desktop. It said smoke. Okay. But then he went to the start menu, went to documents, went to recently opened documents.
And he said he found images. The first document he opened was an image of a young female.
Mm-hmm.
And then he then believed that there was evidence of child pornography in the computer, so he opened two or three more documents, files. But he realized that
right, and then he went and got a warrant. Okay, so here's recent documents. Open it up. Oh, look, it's an image. Okay, and so on. So it's not that there wasn't a warrant, but what was it that gave them the probable cause for the warrant? The first file that he opened. Really, the second file he opened. Okay. So the argument is.
I think the argument stated that he didn't really have.
Why was he opening image files?
Well, his argument. Well, according to the court, it stated that because the.
Well, let's start with what the justification by the officer was that he opened image files. It's in the first full paragraph on 63. Sutherland is the officer. what did Sutherland had previously indicated, I guess at trial, that he was aware that it was an image file and that he was looking for images that might relate to marijuana. You know, pictures in the album that might show him holding a syringe. This testimony, although inconsistent, is not so incredibly dubious or inherently probable that it runs counter to human experience. The trial court was within its discretion as trier of fact to accept Sutherland's testimony as true. So the officer was arguing that it was part of his search. Okay. So what does the court find here, ultimately?
First they were preparing the case between
right.
They were preparing the case to carry.
And what was the carry case, which is the Tenth Circuit case on which
right.
a lot of these either rely or with which they disagree, and the facts at carry
were similar to this one.
Well, what was it? What was the key point about in carry that led the officers to do what was in plain sight?
In carry, the filings were pretty much what they were.
They were looking right. They were suggestive file names.
And these didn't work.
With the suffix JPG, so said it was like childporn.jpg. Oh, this is probably child porn images because that's what the name is, and the name is in plain sight. Now that gives me probable cause to look. After looking at text files, he couldn't open them, but he apparently moved them elsewhere, and he could see them. And so the suspicion changed and had probable cause because of the file names. But what about here?
Here the files were ambiguous.
They were ambiguous. So it wasn't that the file names gave probable cause. They were just files. Smoke did. But maybe. But beyond that, there was no suggestion that these others did. They were just recently opened files. So were they half that? Did this court find that to be in plain sight?
They considered it was
inadvertently discovered. In plain sight. So yes, even though there was a reason given to open up image files, which was not so far out of the realm of credibility. You're shaking your head, but he wasn't looking for child porn, but files were in plain sight in the start menu. Under recent documents on the computer that, you know, again, plain sight is reaching fairly deep into the file system of this computer. Interesting thing. U.S. v. Curtis Williams. Now, Professor Zacharin has remarked to me how many of these cases rely on, involve child pornography. And, you know, in a certain sense, she's absolutely right. But a lot of the reason is that the kinds of cases that get reported, that is, you have written opinions from which you can create a casebook, especially federal cases. If you think about the jurisdiction, I should say, of federal crime, criminal law, over crimes involving computers, you have sort of national security cases, which don't always involve controversies that merit a written opinion, right? Particularly, you have financial kinds of crimes, and you have child porn. So it isn't, and the child porn cases are probably, unlike the other two, child porn cases will involve issues of, it's a lot harder to figure out the margins. I mean, at some level, child porn is already an exception to the First Amendment. It's already, the First Amendment has been stretched because of the balance that there is a compelling state interest in preventing child pornography. That's why child pornography is treated differently than adult pornography. Adult pornography has at least some First Amendment protection. You have to look up the Justice Potter Stewart's, I don't know if it's Potter, that was one other thing, but if you look up the Miller versus California, I think is the case, which is the test for where obscenity can be legally limited under the First Amendment, while indecency cannot necessarily. And it's all about having no artistic merit. There's a nice, clear test. But child porn, it doesn't matter. It can be the most artistic, statement-making, politically driven child pornography. It does not get constitutional protection. But it's not always clear that something is child pornography. This is a really interesting issue. So they ended up, you have a lot of these cases because they raise law enforcement issues, they raise evidentiary issues, they raise technology issues, you can see. And they're pictures sometimes, or they're videos, or they're text. So that's why we have a lot of these cases. A lot of really sick people. So we have the Williams case. Does someone want to share with us the Williams case before I go down the list? Okay, who are we up to now? Saul, are you here? Would you please to share with us U.S. v. Curtis Robert Williams? Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, so it's not the district court. It's an appellate court. Important to know where those courts are because we have somebody from the one above that here today.
I think someone started setting a church,
yes, or at least a church school.
Someone knows the name of Fred McHugh was sending burning emails describing certain acts he would like to perform with some of the children that went to the church.
Right, so you're talking about sexual acts with minors.
Yes.
It's not just, you know, threats. But those specific threats, okay? Okay. Police got a suspect. How'd they get a suspect? It's glossed over, but it's one of those important process of digital forensics. That's okay. Let me help you with that, and then you'll go back with the actual law stuff. So what happened was they went to see who had accessed one of the accounts. It was registered allegedly in the name of the pastor, the father of the pastor. That was the name on the account. Doesn't mean it was actually the person sending it. But then they went to the ISP and said, okay, who accessed this account? And that was, they could get an IP address. They could find out which computer over the internet connected to send mail from this account. And they could track that back to the internet service provider with the date and time. So it's not there, but that's what happened here. And what it said was, they determined that at least one of the email accounts from which emails had been received had been accessed repeatedly by an internet account registered to Carol Williams in Clifton, Virginia, who is the wife of the defendant. So remember, I keep telling you that the best you could get is the account owner? Well, that's exactly what happened here. She wasn't the suspect. At least it seems she wasn't the suspect. But she was the account holder. So from there, they got a warrant to search the house she shared with her husband. And they had, you know, they got a warrant, didn't they? What did the warrant involve? Well, they had all sorts of computers, but based on what? So they had a warrant to search the computers. Based on what?
Based on
All right. So what were the laws under which this warrant was issued? Because that's the key point in this case. They did have a warrant, but a warrant based on what laws? Yes, because it's Virginia. That doesn't tell us anything. What offenses under the Virginia Code?
Prohibiting in-person contact with minors.
Yep.
Good.
And harassment by computer. What wasn't alleged here? There's nothing about pornography. There's nothing about obscenity. This is a warrant looking for evidence regarding computer harassment and bodily harm threats. Right?
Yes.
But what did they determine? What did they discover in that search?
They discovered a DVD which had pictures with children and with sexually explicit acts.
Okay. And they found deleted images. What does that mean, they found deleted images? There were just empty ghosts? That's exactly. Remember I told you about this. They undeleted the images. They found files that had been marked by the computer system for erasure. But were still on the actual hard drive. They ran their little unerase program, and here they were, and they had this DVD marked, I love it, Virus Shield Quarantined Files Destroyed. Yeah, I would think so. I don't think that was the kind of viruses you get from this, though. And they found that many images, right? So, 39 were child pornography. 1,000 were thumbnails of minor boys. And so what was the defendant's defense? What, under what justification does he claim that that evidence seized pursuant to a valid warrant was not admissible, should be suppressed?
He said that the DVD was not part of the search warrant, only the computers that were used for the address, for the email that they sent.
Okay. Was it that there was no warrant for DVDs? Did say digital storage media. So was it the fact that it was a DVD that was of relevance here? What were they supposed to be searching the digital media and the computer for? Evidence of what?
Threats of bodily harm and harassment.
And was this evidence of bodily harm or harassment?
No.
But that was his argument. That, so, in Williams' view of the world, once the police perhaps saw a file name or a deleted image, what should they then have done rather than what they did? What could they have done to forestall any of this?
They could have obtained a warrant.
Sure. They could have gone back to the magistrate and said, Your Honor, we have probable cause that there may be child pornography in this suspect's materials. May we please expand, amend, or get a new warrant to look at that? Done. Search. But they didn't. They didn't. Which opened them up for this allegation of going beyond the warrant and potentially suppression. And what does the court do with that argument? How does the court finally find here? Does the court suppress this evidence? They do not. Why not? If there wasn't a warrant to look for these things, what is the justification?
If I'm not mistaken, I believe it was that they, because they already had seized the computers, and I guess at that point it was fair game or whatever.
No, that isn't. It's not fair game. That's not. There is no fair game exception to the warrant requirement. Even if we were to conclude that the warrant did not authorize a search for child pornography, writes the court, we conclude alternatively that the seizure of the images portraying child pornography was, in any event, justified by the plain view exception to the warrant requirement. What's the plain view here? Anybody else? How are these viewed plainly? This actually is not as challenging as some of the other cases. Right, in this circumstance, they clearly had, it wasn't whether it was records, because some courts, you know, may or may not agree that if you a warrant to cover records covers computer files. Here, they were clearly looking for computer-related data on computers and storage materials. They had authorization to both search, to both seize and search. And once they did not have to dig so deeply. They were in the file listings. They were in the list of deleted files. Now, they did have to view the images. But given that this was not a document, there was, what the court says is, it argues, essentially, it doesn't argue in the alternative. It finds in the alternative. Either because of the particular type of allegations here, the sexual nature of the threats, it was relevant to look for child pornography. Under the original warrant, the laws referenced in the original warrant, or even if that hadn't been the case, says the court, they had the right to search and seize the computers and the records, and these files were found in the digital equivalent of plain sight. Again, they weren't looking for them. They had to sort of do extra things to find them. Less of an excessive point here, right? But still, within the realm of the plain view exception, right? Which brings us to U.S. v. Payton. Somewhat of a different take on this question. So not all the courts are uniform. Jacqueline, you didn't get this far. Okay. You and who else was it? John? Up for next time. Jonathan, you here? Can you help us with Peyton? Thank you.
Maybe a little louder, please.
Okay. And so, was there a warrant? Was there a warrant?
Yes.
What did the warrant authorize the police to search?
Ledgers showing narcotic transactions such as payroll sheets, financial records of persons in control of residence, premises, bank accounts, loan applications, and income tax records.
Okay, and what does the court say, does the opinion say, the very next sentence? Okay, so this court already is differentiating between records generally and records on computers. Good. Go ahead. So, so what's the argument here? So they, again, there was a warrant. It was for other offenses. Lo and behold, they find what they think is child pornography. Eventually they charge him with it. And he argues to suppress. Why?
Because it exceeded the scope of the warrant.
And if it exceeds the scope of the warrant, what is the remedy?
The evidence is suppressed.
Right. Okay. So it's very much the same question that we've seen in these other courts, in these other cases. There is a warrant. It talks about records. Doesn't mention computers. The officer comes over, moves the mouse, brings up the screen, then opens a file, which gives him reasonable suspicion, you know, gives him probable cause, or at least suspicion, to look for others. But then they charge him. So what does this court do with what's the defense of the police? What's their claim? Even if it wasn't part of the warrant?
They claim that there was ample evidence that was reasonable to search the computer because they're related to the Giverson case.
Okay, right. But then beyond that, even if the warrant doesn't cover it, what would the argument be here be? What was the argument in the other cases?
That there are items next to the computer which led to the fake ID for
them
to search.
No. Well, what is that evidence of? What is the exception to the warrant requirement in question here? You're about to say it. What has it been in all these other cases? The plain view exception. The argument is, it's right there. The fake ID stuff in Giberson was right there. Giberson was right there. Here, the files were right there. So yeah. So first of all, they've got to make these two-stage arguments. That the warrant covered the computer and the files were in plain view on the computer covered by a warrant. And what does the court say?
It wasn't covered.
So, this evidence is suppressed. Suppressed. Here, the court does not read that warrant language broadly. Does not say records include computer records. And having not read it broadly, or having read it narrowly, so you'd really have to get to two levels of plain view, which didn't stop some of the other courts. But here, the court is not willing to say that the view of the search of the computer, if it wasn't covered by the warrant, is within the plain view exception. And more to the point, the file search of the computer was not. Now, one wonders, because of the particular facts of this case, supposing that in searching the desk, what it says is the officer bumped the mouse and the screensaver went off, which is not out of the realm. What if there had been a child pornographic image on the computer? Did not have the right to search the computer according to this case, the court. But what difference might that have made?
It rises probable cause for the officer to search the computer now. If it's in plain sight.
Well, that's the question then, right? Would his viewing of that, in my hypothetical, which is a great test question, make a note of that, right? In my hypothetical, what would be the difference there? The original viewing of the picture happened why? By accident, right? You have these you knock something over and it opens a drawer. Those are sort of more generally in the plain view exception, right? Had it been on the screen, or even better, His screen protector was going through images on his computer. All right? Different case entirely, probably not rising to the level of a reported opinion. But it wasn't. And this court is not willing to go that far. Now, what's the lesson we learn? Now, the lesson we learn from this story is what? How are you, whether you're future law enforcement people, I'm not if you're a defense lawyer, the lesson you learn is the courts most of the time can read the plain view exception very broadly. But if you're counseling law enforcement officials, what do you counsel them with regard to warrant language, for example? How might the Peyton case have been different, even if they didn't know they were looking for child pornography, with the warrant language? Include the computers, right? If you're looking for records, I mean, look at the warrant language, for example, in the previous case. Any and all computer systems and digital storage media, videotapes, etc., and instrumentalities. Had the law enforcement officials in the Peyton case included computers, they might well have succeeded on the plain view exception for the files on those computers, even if they were looking for something else. But they didn't. So some of this is understanding, some of this is, but you have to think broadly in terms of the ways this evidence might be presented. And ideally, your officers then go and get a warrant once they get that first hint of probable cause, assuming it's not going to be destroyed, so that they don't have to worry about reaching for the plain view exception after the fact. It's always worse to rely on an exception rather than the warrant requirement. Okay, you have a question?
Can the warrant be as broad as to state, the evidence is not being used to prove the drug sales could be on any media?
I think that's going to be up to the magistrate. Obviously, there is a particularity requirement. So you can't just say, I'm going to look at the house for stuff. But, and there's also a question, if you said computers but not DVDs. So you want to be as broad as the facts, right? The probable cause and the magistrate standards will allow in order to get all relevant evidence legally. All right, next week we continue with this. The reading is pages 141 to 160. Next class, anyway. Oh, and if you get a chance, watch War Games. We'll talk about it. Have watched War Games. Did you actually watch it last week? For the first time? Right. For the first time?
No, I've seen it like 30 times.
Good for you. I approve. Have you read a book called Ready Player One? Having watched War Games a whole lot is extremely important for the protagonist in this book. If you like computer games and stuff, Ready Player just and 80s pop culture, Ready Player One, a lot of fun to read. Not during the semester because you have other things to do.